Welcome to the American Classroom Podcast, where we explore the role of education in building a civil society. I'm with my co-host, Lindsay Crosland, and today we have Dr. Vernon Smith. Very excited to have Dr. Smith with us, one of the most innovative minds in education here in America. Dr. Smith did his undergrad at Brigham Young University and graduate work in organizational management at BYU as well, and then a doctorate in higher education at University of Arizona. I will say, Dr. Smith, you're talking to two sun devils here. So
I understand we all have our weaknesses, so that's okay.
That's right. I think Lindsay took a few classes at BYU, so you know you got that. So I was talking to somebody that was a big BYU fan, and they had a BYU. I said, "Is that Dodger blue?" Because the Dodgers are in the World Series. Just won the World Series last night, and they said, "No ways."
It's BYU blue.
BYU blue. Yep, they're 8-0 right now, undefeated.
It's an amazing year. This hasn't happened since 1984 that they've done
such well. They won the national championship.
Right. But we're not going to jinx it, so we're just going to just take it game by game.
Well, thank you for being here. Thank you for spending your precious time to visit with us here. When I met you, you had told me about something called dual enrollment that you were working on when you were at Rio Salado College. And I specifically remember thinking, that sounds like it's noise. Because I had just started with my father at Heritage Academy in Mesa, Arizona. And I just thought it was a distraction. And then he was on a plane with somebody that brought it up separately. And I said, he says, "Have you ever heard about this thing called dual enrollment?" And anyways, fast forward, you were telling me to do things way ahead of time. And it took me a couple of years to realize, oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. He actually told me about that. I blew him off a little bit. This guy's ahead of times. And that's always what I think of, Vernon, when I think of visiting with you. Is like, okay, this guy's 2 or 3, maybe 5 years ahead of the industry. And it's going to be fun to pick your brain on innovation and what you're working on. But let me just have you summarize a little bit about your journey through the education so far, and just bring our listeners up to speed on your background.
Sure. Thanks, Jared and Lindsay. It's great to be here with you. And, you know, it's always good to see you. I was 21 years at Rio Salado College, which is one of the Maricopa Community Colleges. And that, you know, time there, I was faculty. I'm a business and Spanish language faculty, Latin American studies. It's my background. I was there and I went from faculty chair. I was actually started as an adjunct faculty chair for the languages. Then I became Dean of Institutional Effectiveness, which really turned quickly into the Dean of Instruction for Elder Academics. And then I was selected by the president, then Dr. Linda Thor, as her Vice President of Academic Affairs. And so I continued on that. So it was quite a journey of progress and learning things. And along the way, Rio Salado College is known for its innovation nationally, especially in terms of access. And let me go back and then I'll come back to Rio and talk a little bit about dual enrollment and why that was really critical as an innovation. After I was courted by a former program officer at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to start a college up from scratch. And the college was called Portmont College at Mount St. Mary's, which is in LA. So go Dodgers, right? They were our partner and we started this college from scratch. It was a two-year, it was basically a community college, but it was low cost. Their tuition was around $46,000 a year. And we were able to do this two-year degree for less than $10,000 online, targeting low-income young adults and working adults that needed that opportunity. I got that basically launched with that. And then the Gates funding sort of changed. Sometimes they do that. They change their priorities or other things. And there were other funding sources. Reed Hastings was actually a funder in the early days of that. That was also a time in higher ed where there's a lot of really strange dynamics going on with enrollment and other things. But I got the college launched. It's successful today. In fact, Mount St. Mary's at a university in Los Angeles, now they have, you know, online associates, bachelor's and master's degree, even though they're landlocked. They're up there in Chalon, which is above the Getty Museum, and down on like Adams and Figueroa, right by USC. And they can't grow physically because it's LA. It's just cramped there. But now they can grow technologically. They can grow with greater access that way. As that wrapped up, I was courted by the University of the Pacific, and I got to work under a fantastic leader, Dr. Maria Pallavicini, who was the provost there and recruited me to basically help the institution do its digital transformation. So what did that mean? It means a couple things. I sort of highlight that. One was working with a Center for Continuing and Professional Education and making partnerships in the community for workforce development and for professionalization and retraining, especially of teachers. That was one of our big customers doing that. Another part was building a Center for Teaching and Learning and sort of revamping that with a great team. Terry Johnson was my director and just had a fantastic crew of folks that were there. And built instructional design, migrated the learning management system from an old Sakai version to, we did a Canvas at that time. In the meantime, did a lot of research. They have three campuses, one in Sacramento, San Francisco, and Stockton, California. We're going to go on a little trivial pursuit because I'm the king of useless and useful information. But the Stockton campus is actually where George Lucas filmed Indiana Jones.
Oh, wow.
Where Professor Jones had his classroom and things like that.
Dr. Jones.
And it looks like it's in Chicago or, you know, back in New York or something like that. But you can go into the classroom. You can see the actual classrooms where the FBI, you know, did the interrogation of Indiana Jones. And it's because George Lucas was from the Central Valley there, from Modesto. And so anyway, that's a little bit of fun. But at the three different campuses, I set up new programs, primarily graduate. Like in San Francisco, I stood up, helped with fantastic faculty. Former Cisco guy, Rick Hutley, we set up a data science program. We set up a food studies and an audiology program in San Francisco. They have a dental school that's a three-year accelerated dental school. Up in Sacramento, where they have a law school, we actually did the foundation for a health sciences offering and offered a physician assistant program. Right. And this is all sometimes location, your physical location is the key to access. And then in Stockton, of course, we were working on increasing our online offerings, and including with that was open educational resources so that students didn't have to pay so much for textbooks. In fact, zero cost for that. I got recruited from University of Pacific by a dear colleague, Dr. Karen Powell, who's a wonderful leader. She was the former provost at American Public University System. And she basically said, Vernon, you're doing a lot of good in this. How would you like to do that at an even greater scale? And I said, well, and how would you like to help serve veterans and active duty military personnel and other working adults? And I said, you sold me. I mean, don't twist my arm. We will do that. And so I was recruited to American Public University System as the provost and senior vice president. And there, we'll talk a little bit more as we go this, but increased OE open educational resources to where that pretty much all your general ed was open educational resources. And because the university paid for the undergraduate textbooks, it was directly to the bottom line. And so you can understand that. So that's, you know, millions of dollars of savings over time. Did things with adaptive learning, updating the learning management system, which this time we, with the faculty of that process, chose Desire to Learn, which I think right now is probably the cutting edge LMS. That's my advice for folks right now. If you're looking at something that there, I'm not paid or have no part with them, but you know, if I were looking at a learning management system that I needed to stand up today, that would be the one I would look at, it, at least in higher ed. I'd have to look at K-12. And I did that for a while. There was a lot of churn with presidents in my time. I had some really great presidents but they kept churning, and I had five presidents in 5 years. And there came the time that I wanted to start looking at other opportunities. And so I took a sabbatical, and now I'm actually the first, because I made up the position, because there's some really creative people at the League for Innovation and the Community College. And so that's based in Chandler, Arizona. That's its headquarters. And it's actually virtual, but the League for Innovation in the Community College is a fantastic organization that brings the top innovative forward-thinking colleges in America. You know, there's around 1,200 community and technical colleges in America. And then look at what are the best practices? How can we spread and disseminate innovation across that. And my job right now is I'm looking at, and Jared, are you familiar with the Good to Great books, Jim Collins?
Collins, yeah, Court, they're wonderful.
So what I'm doing is I'm capturing, because there's a whole new generation of leaders that are coming in, and some of them are leaving, but I want to capture those good to great journeys of community colleges, community and technical colleges, and understand what did they do to make that journey? What was the pain or problem that started it? What was their pathway or their methodology? And what was the payoff? What was the result? Primarily in, I think, in student access, quality, and lower cost that they were able to do. And so that's what I'm doing research as I look for my next gig. So I am out there. I'm available for consulting, but I'm actually looking for my next big gig as I do this. So that's a lot talking. Now, let me stop and go back to dual enrollment. So Rio Salado made a really interesting bet under Dr. Linda Thor. They were in around 235 different locations. We were, and it was all around the body because it was a college without a campus. When Dr. Thor came there, she talked about things like shared governance, which is something big in California where she had come from. But coming to Arizona, which is a right-to-work state, it didn't really resonate with the staff or the faculty or others. And she's like a smart cookie. She's one of the most intelligent people I've ever met. And she said, you know what? I need to change the frame here. I need to change the language. So she said, would you be interested in total quality management or continuous quality improvement? And they said, oh, tell us about that. That might be something you did. And so she started on this journey of continuous quality improvement. And instead of trying to do the traditional way of doing this, which calls for high participation, collaboration, and really surfacing the ideas. And a lot of this is, of course, Linda's personality, but she's like a dynamic leader in that sense. What we did is we said we're going to focus our strategy around accelerated programs, customized programs, and online or distance learning programs. And so I was involved in all three of those. And the one that would be accelerated program, we consider dual enrollment as an accelerated program. So when I left Rio Salado, I mean, besides having, it's not all me, but it's also, you know, you got to have like a person like EJ Anderson, who is just a phenomenal, thoughtful person who understands the fabric of Maricopa Community College, of Maricopa County, and especially the East Valley, of understanding this. But we went out and we built partnerships with over 50 at that time K-12 districts and schools. And, you know, at that time when I took, it was around 6,700 equivalent full-time enrollment for students. Now, who are these students? A lot of them may never step foot on a community college campus. But if we can accelerate that, there's a couple of great benefits for that. They tend to be retained longer, and they tend to see themselves as college students, which is the most important transformative thing. So as we know, if a student has 21 hours, they're very likely to continue and complete their bachelor's degree. Well, you know, I'm thinking that at your schools, Jared, they've taken that to heart. And actually, if I remember correctly, some of your folks are, meaning your students, your wonderful students, are actually walking across the high school graduation stage. And at the same time, or a day before or after, they're actually being awarded an Associate of Arts degree or Associate of Science degree.
We have one school that has 60% of their graduating class. Their graduating class is just a little over 100, maybe 110, that is doing just that. Another school is 40%. And actually the one that's a little lower is the one I'm more excited about. Our campus in Levine, which is South Phoenix, which is a very tough neighborhood, they have roughly, Lindsay, you can correct me, about 15 to 20% of their graduates, again, about 100, that are getting their associates. But the big difference is that most of them are first gen college. So the first one in their family tree to go to college, which is why I'm more excited. It's huge.
And let me just interject here. So for the audience that may not know what dual enrollment is, we can just do a quick explanation. So Jared's referring to Heritage Academy schools. And I think it's fun that Vernon had brought this up years ago And then Heritage Academy schools implemented them at the different campuses, and they all have their different levels of participation. But essentially, the teachers at the high school are certified to teach as college professors. And so the students are enrolling concurrently. A lot of places it's called concurrent enrollment. The students are maybe taking physics, taking econ while they're in high school, but they're also enrolled in the college credit. So they accumulate college credit as they're just going through high school through taking the same class that they would have normally, paying a fraction of the tuition or scholarship to the tuition and working their way toward an associate degree by the time they graduate with their diploma, like you referenced. So they could have 10 credits, they could have 15 credits, they could have 20 credits by the time they graduate, but they can just do year by year and incrementally earn those credits. So college credit in high school while you're in high school in the same seat, not going half day to a college campus, but just doing it while you're in class. So that's a major innovation as I see it in the K-12 space.
You know, sometimes I refer in my language, dual enrollment is college classes at the high school with college instructors. Whereas concurrent, sometimes I say a high school student goes over to the college campus and actually does it on the campus. And but, you know, it's used interchangeably across the United States, depending on the state. And, you know, in some states, it's fully funded. But, you know, that is an innovation journey. I remember the first time I heard about dual enrollment, there was a French chair of the department at Mountain Point High School who would say, "Hi, this is Joanne Pomba. I want to talk about doing dual enrollment." And she filled up my, and then she would call back, "Hi, this is Joanne Pompa. Please give me a call." And she actually literally filled up. I had one of those old machines that answering machines. She literally filled up my answer machine. Well, Mountain Point High School was very important because there's a faculty there by the name of John Lassen. He's passed away. Wonderful man. He was taught calculus. And he said, "You know, why can't I get dual in my kids' college credit for this? I use the same syllabus at ASU. I'm using the same syllabus when I teach at, you know, this college over here at night. And I use the same syllabus for you. Why can't our students get that?" And he came and he said, well, he came to Linda Thor and a couple others and said, we said, why not? You know, they're qualified. Obviously they can do it. And languages are similar. You know, these students, for me, I was the chair of languages at the time. I said, if these students can perform, we'll do this. Well, we did that. We went through that process. In fact, later down the story is Rio Salado became the first NACEP-accredited community college nationally to get that. Syracuse University was one of the first, but it's the accrediting body for high-quality dual enrollment programs, and we did this. But we made sure that everything was in place, and this is sort of the three things I'd say about innovation. You absolutely need to have a need that needs to be solved. You need to have the infrastructure. And that's both technological and people that can support the program. And then, you know, you need the underlying supporting culture that was this. John said he complained. He was trying to shop dual enrollment, John Lassen, at all the community colleges. And finally, Brian ended up at Rio Salado. And, you know, the rest is, you know, as they say, is somewhat history. At a certain point, they split Rio because Rio was the dominant dual enrollment, and they split it amongst the different colleges in the district. I think over time, I think there's a service level. This is an outside opinion, but there's a service level that's required and an infrastructure that's required to assure quality and assure good learning outcomes, which is what it's all about, right? I had lots of fights with my instructional council, which was made up of my peers around, saying these kids can't do college work. And the best way to do that was and said, well, great, let's do blind. Let's do some blind studies. Let's do comparable. Let's do take the same final examinations, the same assessments, exact same assessments to see where they score. Well, I had done it internally. And what I found is that my dual enrollment students in languages were scoring 5 and 6 points above, you know, my traditional adult learning students in online or in-person classrooms. And I presented that to my colleagues and they backed off very quickly saying, well, no, we know you do it well. But, you know, I would go to board meetings and other things, and there were those that wanted to really shut it down. they saw it as mission creep. And that's one of the other, I think, lessons for innovation. When someone starts accusing you of mission creep, you're on the right track.
Yeah, that's a good sign.
It is, because you're expanding the boundaries. Frankly, the same thing was at that same time that we weren't as successful was getting a baccalaureate degree.
You know, now, yeah, Governor Ducey signed that, and that's in play. Now, Vernon, when you were at Rio, if I remember correctly, Rio Salado was cited in that red book, The Innovative University, by Christensen and Eyring. Because of this and other things, I think you had a lot to do with as the fastest growing community college in the U.S. And that was huge. I think it was over 60,000 students, or it was a large number that you were servicing because you were, you know, there was mission creep.
Remember that three-pronged thing of accelerated programs, right? Customized training for business and industry, and then of course, distance learning. Distance learning is probably where I feel like I made a lot of the difference. So I put the first language courses online in Arizona. And so we started with Spanish, quickly went to French, German, American Sign Language was fun. But we didn't have the greatest technologies back then. We didn't have near the bandwidth that we have on the internet now, as a lot of it was dial-up in the 90s, especially for our students. And so we used telephones. We'd use a telephone system for auditory things, because if you have an idea, you can adapt the technology, find the tool for it. Now, if I were doing it again, it was so much fun building things. In fact, I'd probably use an AI interface for your chatting companion and say, okay, here's my AI companion from Argentina, and they're from Buenos Aires, and I want you to have a conversation and have a chat back and forth about, going to the store and buying something. But anyway, I put the language courses online. The other thing that was really important was we started using big data at that point. And I had a wonderful institutional research group. And one of them in particular, we had a conversation one day about redlining. And that's where, oftentimes loans for folks will not, if you're on this side of the zip code or that side of the zip code, you can get a loan or you can't get a loan because of where you live. And we looked at that as something, okay, well, what if you could take that data that they used? Another thing is like, hello, Mr. Smith, I see that you purchased a surfboard in Malibu. Is this really you? And of course, it's not me, right? The credit card company, they use data like that. And we said, how can we use that data for good? And so we started doing big data and predictive modeling for our students, starting with online, and saw that we could actually predict whether a student would get a C or better in the class by the seventh day. And that's a 70% accuracy rate. You could go to Vegas on that. Don't go to Vegas, Jared, for that, or Lindsay. But, those are good betting odds. And we just improved it from there. And I was doing that, the data, just so that we could have an early intervention. If we have a student that is in the green, well, that student that indicates that they have a high prediction that they're going to successfully can be the class. When they do something well, they need to be reinforced. They need to be told that they're doing well and what they're doing well. Feedback is not true feedback unless it gives you information for improvement. Good job is not feedback. Any teacher that's out there, I challenge any teacher, if you're writing good job and that's it on the student's paper or giving them that feedback, that is inadequate. That is not true assessment and true teaching. You need to tell them how they improve. So we did that for the green students. The yellow students that were at risk, then we used different resources, right? That was a faculty intervention. That was student services intervention. That was using our instructional help desk to do that. And then the red students, of course, sometimes red was just because they hadn't got engaged. So it was messaging saying, hey, the class started. Are you ready to go? And sometimes we could save those students. And that prediction, it basically looked at things like, did you log into class? We can do an analog. Did you show up to class? Right? Did you participate in the discussions? Were you going through the material? Right? When you took tests, how'd you do on those in comparison to others? And those algorithmic, Boolean thing that we did, was able to help us predict that. And that's the same thing that most predictive modeling systems use now, when they're trying to predict student success, but it goes to, do you show up to class? Are you active in your participation? Are you doing well? When you fail, are you improving over time? And how are you improving in comparison to your peers? Those are our important assessment things. So in Rio Salado, the result of these type of things, we experienced double-digit growth for over a decade. When I left, there was six, Rio doesn't have as many now, but it's around 40, maybe 48,000. Right now, when I left, Rio Salado was 62,000 students. 42,000 of those were online. And then the other thing that we did to shatter the access was we made it possible through a group, a cross-functional team that we created called the development team. And we worked on increasing the number of start dates you could have. So we had 4 start dates a year. Then we went to 12 start dates a year and built the infrastructure around it, right? You have to have the support systems for that. We went from 12 to 26 starts per year. And then we actually went to 52 starts a year, but that was impractical. So we backed it off to 48 starts per year. So a student now at Rio Salado College can start a class the next Monday. Or if you're on the holidays, sort of the year end and fiscal year in July, you need to wait another Monday, but you can start that, which basically shattered the agrarian schedule for what students would expect and gave them opportunities. So for example, languages grew tremendously because they would start the semester at ASU and students would need Spanish 202 or equivalent to be able to graduate with a Bachelor of Arts in the Arizona system, right? And so they, it's already started, they're out, they're locked out. Well, they could come to Rio Salado and get those credits and be able to do that with flexibility. And so those, that's, you know, I'm rambling here, but it's, you know, the idea of, again, you have to have that vision, you have to have that infrastructure, you have to have that culture of understanding the need, understanding the infrastructure, and have the people in place to do that. So for dual enrollment, that was understanding the need that's it's out there. We had no idea how big it was. When you talk about dual enrollment now, people say, thank you. Oh my gosh, that's awesome. That is so great. You know, that is, you know, it saved me so much money. My kid did this or that, and it saves money, but it improves the quality of the instruction, which is awesome for a K-12 system in the high school, you know, doing that. So, you know, some of the ideas that are doing that, Jared, I'd ask you. So some of your teachers may not have had the credentials yet. And being able to teach dual enrollment probably gave them an incentive, I imagine, to be a college professor, because then they could not only teach at the high school, they could also teach at the college, but they would up their skill level and their professional credentials.
It's true. And they appreciated that. And then maybe about 5 years ago, Governor Ducey actually created the Arizona Teacher Academy, which if a teacher is not qualified but likes to be, then the state will provide a little tuition support through the major universities so they can get qualified, which has been appreciated as well. One thing that's really great, we had our Levine campus again, that story, it's in a very distressed area, and it always had either a C letter grade or a B letter grade because it's dealing with the hardest of the cases. Lots of children there living with grandparents, and they're moving all the time. Well, just this week, that school was given an A letter grade, which is huge. And I think it goes to the point you're making, is because the teacher quality, because the dual enrollment program is operating, it ups the game of the teacher quality. And then the scholars follow and they started before.
Absolutely. I just think it's, you know, the partnership between a community college that's and wants to work with them and say, you know, it's part of this, like, we're partners. We're not transactional people. We're actual partners. And I'm invested in your future as a high school. I want you to be better. And, you know, we may never see these students, you know. Students in Levine, they may never go to a Rio Salado. But my goodness, they're going to be well prepared when they go to a university or other community college.
Well, you know what we did that other schools haven't done? Well, one school did in particular. I can't remember if I asked you or if it was EJ Anderson or Royce, but I said, who does this the best? Who's the gold standard in Arizona? And they looked at each other and they said, oh, it's Sister Joni.
Oh, yeah.
The Catholic girls school in Phoenix.
Yeah, and Xavier said, College Prep. Yeah.
I said, would you go please ask Sister Joni if I could come over and meet her and learn from her and see what the magic is, because they had been doing this for 20 years before us and partner with you guys. And they just had this 4-year process that was second to none. And I said, I want to learn. Anyways, she was so gracious. She came back with, she had a little folder she put together just for Heritage. She says, here, go share this with Heritage. This is everything we do. We just right up front, give them a 4-year plan and they have the whole thing and they get it done. And most of, and now Vernon at graduation, which is a couple of weeks before high school, Dr. Thor was presiding. She's now the governing board chair of all the community colleges. More than half of the graduating class is Heritage Academy and Xavier. And Sister Johnny, she waves at me. And
I love it.
Like, I owe you big time, Sister Johnny. Thank you.
But
the secret there that she did and what we copied is we took the magic that was offered by you and the college, and we just put it into a repeatable process at our level from the partner standpoint, because I think you would offer this so many times like you did to me early on. And we're like, yeah, okay, maybe, you know,
I'm just making me think, Jared,
catch the vision.
There's something in my, you know, that's an area for improvement for me, is like, you know, what could I have done to, you know, just like get, maybe I needed like take you to lunch or something like that and just really lay it out. There's just something else that I needed to connect to express that value. But I'm so glad you came upon it.
I love that example of collaboration with Sister Joni. I think that's how all students throughout the U.S. win, is when schools are willing to help each other, like, elevate their game and not feel competitive or protective of the programs they're offering their students. So that's a really great example. Dr. Smith, I also really like that your focus in your career has been on making these programs affordable for students. I think affordability is huge, because I think we think of innovation as the shiny new thing that, oh, it needs lots of infrastructure, all these monies to grow and think about the future. But if we can keep it affordable for students, then it's actually going to be successful.
If you like this episode, please like and share with someone who would find this interesting. We appreciate you listening to the American Classroom podcast today.
Thank you.
American Classroom is brought to you by Heritage Academy. Heritage Academy Levine is a public charter school serving grades 6 through 12 in Arizona. Youth that come to Heritage Academy Levine are not just students, but scholars who are taught by the number one rated faculty in Arizona. If you would like to learn more about Heritage Academy Levine, visit heritageacademyaz.com and click Levine.